talks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animal, talking animal. Talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animal.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is Stacey LeBaron, a veteran animal welfare advocate with a particular passion for felines. As such, she hosts the Community Cats podcast, a program LeBaron produces three times per week, in which she interviews prominent experts, chiefly about topics involving the cat overpopulation issue and cat welfare. If this sounds at first blush like too much of a specialized niche, especially for a thrice weekly program, then you haven't heard the Community Cats podcast, which in fact covers tremendous and varied ground, reflecting LeBaron's considerable expertise and commitment to felines of all kinds. Before she launched the podcast, she served for 16 years as president of the Merrimack River Feline Rescue Society in Massachusetts. So we'll hear about the podcast, her longstanding zeal for cats, and more when I speak with Stacey LeBaron in a few moments here on Talking Animals. Later, I'll speak with Gina Kaiser about a forthcoming benefit in Palm Harbor for Paws with a Cause, which seeks to increase awareness of the rights and roles of assistance dog teams. Lastly, the show isn't usually about tooting my own horn. It's usually about tooting other people's horns. But for various reasons, including our periodic discussions on the show about greyhound racing, I've been urged to mention the story I recently wrote for the Washington Post Animal Blog, which delves into greyhound racing in Florida, where 12 of the 19 remaining dog tracks in the U.S. are located. It's a screwy, confounding world, starting with those tracks being required to offer racing, even though they collectively lose about $30 million a year doing so in order to operate their highly lucrative card rooms. The feedback I've received is that the story is pretty illuminating and pretty infuriating, given what it means for the dogs. It was published Friday, and you can find it by putting Washington Post and Animalia, that's Animal and IA, in your search engine. It was also posted a few days ago on my Facebook page and the Talking Animals Radio Show Facebook page. My thanks to Don Goldstein, our ongoing greyhound correspondent here on Talking Animals, for his expertise and assistance in researching and preparing this piece. Now let's get to Stacey and cats, with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing DJ at WMNF.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Stacey LeBaron to Talking Animals. Good morning, Stacey.
Morning, Duncan. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining me on Talking Animals. And, of course, we'll spend more than a little time discussing the podcast and as well as your previous work with the Merrimack River Feline Rescue Society and other hats you're wearing these days. But let me start by asking, what's your first memory of a cat?
Well, we had a cat named Duncan growing up.
A cat named Duncan?
Cat named Duncan. Yeah.
Oh my God! Well, that's all. I think we've concluded the interview. I don't think it could get any better than that. At least for me. Okay, please go ahead, though.
Sorry. Yeah. So my mom adopted a little kitten named Duncan, and she thought Duncan was a boy at the time. And when Duncan got to be about 6 months old, took Duncan in to get neutered at the vet, and it turned out Duncan was a girl when she got spayed. Duncan was older than I was, so I sort of grew up with her as a baby, and she taught me how to respect the cat and really made sure that I knew she was queen of the house.
And just out of curiosity, Stacey, what kind of cat was Duncan?
She was just a regular tabby cat.
Orange tabby, by any chance?
No, unfortunately, okay. A gray tabby.
Okay. No, only reason I'm asking is that we had an experience with sort of a quasi-feral that descended on us many years ago, and the same kind of deal. We thought for sure male cat was orange tabby, and then when we took it in, later learned female. So I just thought maybe it was orange tabby as well, which I guess were predominantly male, which is one of the reasons we thought that was the case. But
right. I actually have an orange tabby now that is female, Misha.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
And how many other cats do we have on hand there at the LeBaron household?
I currently, I've actually scaled back. I only have two. So
wow.
I have Hooch and I have Misha. Yep.
Hoots? Is that Hooch. What you said? Yeah.
Hooch. Yeah, like Turner and Hooch, but
yeah.
I didn't get Turner. I got Hooch.
Okay.
And, yeah, Hooch has a nice little left ear tip, and Hooch is FIV positive, and he's a great cat. He's sort of one of those dog-like cats. And then Misha came from an abandoned house as a kitten. She never really socialized that great, so she's sort of Hooch's pal more than anybody else's pal.
I see. Backing up a little bit, was there something about the Duncan experience that served as a profound cat bonding thing, or was your cat love more cultivated cumulatively from multiple cats over the years? Because clearly there's some special connection that you feel with cats.
Yeah, well, you know, it's sort of, I think, a culmination of different events that happened over the years. I actually was trained in architecture and urban planning, and then I did a little bit of study in nonprofit management at the New School in New York City. So I did have some familiarity with nonprofit work a little bit. And over the years, there were like bits and pieces of like hints of things that, you know, something was up here. When I lived in Cambridge, Massachusetts for a while, there were a lot of outdoor cats, and I liked feeding them. I would just go out and I'd feed these cats on various stoops in different places in Cambridge. And I used to always get pretty upset driving along the highway, and I'd see cats that had been hit by a car. Whenever I saw a cat hit by a car, I thought, oh, this is terrible. Why is this happening? This shouldn't, you know, happen. And it just seemed like there was an awful lot of them out there, and that was back in the 1970s and the early 80s, where really cat overpopulation was substantially worse than it is now across the country. And so, it was pretty common to see, you know, a cat that had been hit by a car, or kittens, something like that. So when I moved into the Newburyport area in Massachusetts, I joined up with this group that had just formed 2 years earlier that was very concerned about the cats on the Newburyport waterfront. And it sort of was like one foot in front of the other, which was, well, I could do this, and so I did it for them. And then, well, I could do that, and then I did that. And, you know, and then the sort of the list got longer and longer, and soon enough, I became president of the organization.
So this newfound group then clearly was the Merrimack River Feline Rescue
mm-hmm.
Society.
Yeah, they were founded in 1992, and then I joined the group in 1994.
I see. So I guess there was always kind of a cat through line, but it also seemed like you were driven by professional and geographic wanderings that kind of maybe led to specifically connecting with the Merrimack River Feline Rescue Society.
Yeah, I mean, I felt that I could really make a difference and help with impacting the situation. I had good business skills. I always knew that I had pretty good business skills, and that was something that the organization needed at the time. And I really wanted to control cat overpopulation, and it seemed pretty simple to me. Even back then, I would always reference Adam and Eve. You know, it's just about Adam and Eve and preventing them from being able to have more kittens. And so if we could just ensure that every cat out there needed to be spayed or neutered had access to either affordable or free spay-neuter, you know, a lot of our problems would be solved.
Wow. All right. Well, that's seeing it with that kind of clarity and simplicity is great, and obviously I'm sure led to your long, successful stint there. Early on, at least, did you occasionally sort of look up and say, wow, I've got this cool job, and I'm working with cats, trying to make life better for cats?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I love cats, obviously, and I love the people that work with cats, incredibly passionate group of people, and, you know, all different backgrounds. The one thing I really enjoyed in my 20 years working with the Merrimack River Feline Rescue Society was the fact that, you know, these are folks that I normally wouldn't be swinging with. I tend to play tennis, and, you know, not everybody's a tennis player that's involved and passionately in love with cats. So I got to meet some fascinating people just around this topic of cats, and everybody brought some special sauce to the mix, and it made us very, very successful.
And before we go any further, yeah, that's cool the way it does bring together people of all different sort of interests and passions and walks of life. But what, over these years, and including obviously now, what particularly appeals to you about cats? How do they speak to you in a certain way that's obviously guided your career and then guided you into the podcast, which we'll get into in a moment?
So cats themselves are independent beings, and I really appreciate that. They test us. where dogs are so focused on us all of the time and they're so dependent on us, I feel that there's more of a negotiated arrangement between us and cats, and so they're testing us on our ability to be able to work within their parameters. And so that's really where my passion has been. And then certainly the individual characters of cats that I have owned over the years, many of them have touched me. I have a very big soft spot for fostering cats that are 10 years of age and older. So where others might like to foster kittens, and that's great, and do bottle baby kittens and all that stuff, I had a weak spot for the ones that were 10 years and older, and I would be bringing the older cats to my house and foster them and try and adopt them out from my house. So many different faces and names have come through my house. My kids have learned to love those cats, and it's just been an incredible experience. And that's the reason why, you know, each day, even though it might be challenging at times, I just wanted to persevere and move forward.
Yeah. So what all, before we move on too far, what all did the Merrimack River Feline Rescue Society do? I mean, what sort of programs, especially over the stint where you were leading the organization, what all did it do, and what did it accomplish, do you think?
Yeah, sure. So the Merrimack River Feline Rescue Society was founded back in 1992 because in Newburyport, Massachusetts, because we had a colony of over 300 cats living on the Newburyport waterfront area, which is a touristy area. There's about a dozen restaurants down there and boat yards. So in the winter times, the cats would get in the boats and they'd use those for shelter, and then the boat owners would get really grumpy in the springtime when they'd see the cats there. The restaurants liked having the cats around for mousers, but yet they'd get injured, they'd have runny, goopy eyes, you know, they'd be feeding out of the dumpsters, and so there was really no one taking care of those cats. So there were some residents that set up a group of feeding stations. We had 14 different feeding stations in the Newburyport area and started trapping and what we call trap, neuter, and return, trap, neuter, and returning those cats back to the colony to help support, prevent the growth of the population in that area. So that started in 1992. I'd say by 1998, we had the population reduced down to about 40 or 50 cats. And then by 2008, the very last cat passed away on the waterfront. And so now there are no more free-roaming cats in that area. I mean, there are some indoor-outdoor-owned cats, but they are owned, and we know who the owners are, and they're microchipped and all that. So we've gone from 300-plus cats to zero, you know, in 2008. So that was sort of our first targeted spay-neuter project. Over the years, we also started an adoption center, and then we also started free spay-neuter clinics for feral cats that was run with volunteer veterinarians, as well as two mobile spay-neuter clinics called the Catmobile. And so in my tenure, we assisted about 110,000 cats.
That's a lot of cats. That's great. With those efforts and with that colony going from 300 to 40, 50, and then down to zero, as you implemented those other programs, did other colonies pop up, or were they almost preemptively prevented from developing to any degree based on those programs that you were and your colleagues were implementing?
Yeah, so basically what we did in Newburyport was that was sort of the center of the nucleus or whatever, and we expanded from there. So we did not have, at that point in time, what one would consider a vacuum effect to a great degree. We did have some newcomers, and every now and again, you know, a cat would be abandoned in the area. That significantly ended in 2003 when we, our shelter, created an open admission policy. So once we had open admission policy, then anybody who needed assistance with their cats could come in without having any judgments or, you know, having to make a million appointments or whatever. For our service area, people could bring their cats in and we would just accept them, and we operate that with the no-kill philosophy too. We, you know, we use that as sort of the central part, and we just sort of branched out from there. And so we were able to really do an intense coverage over eastern Massachusetts. And so intake rates in the area shelters have dropped by 60 to 70% for cats.
Oh, my goodness. That's dramatic. And so I guess really kind of acknowledge that at first it might have been a little oversimple, but really your view when you first got into working for Merrimack River Feline Rescue Society was like, hey, it doesn't seem like it'd be that hard to reduce the population, which is both kind of beautifully naive on the one hand, but it seemed like you actually achieved it, at least in your given area that you were focused.
Oh, we definitely did.
Yeah.
We started our mobile spay-neuter clinics in 2008, and some area organizations also started some low-cost spay-neuter programs. So in conjunction as a group, starting in 2008, we started seeing a significant drop in numbers for cats and kittens. And kittens is the first wave. The first wave, you're going to see a drop in your kitten intakes. Then the adult cats, you're going to see that wave happen about 8 months after that period with the intense spay-neuter program. And you're just going to see a dramatic drop. I mean, the Massachusetts Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, they have a facility in Methuen, Massachusetts, and it's huge, and it can house quite a few cats, and the numbers of cats are down so much that they're putting chickens in some of their community cat rooms to be able to profile them for adoption because they don't have enough cats to fill the space.
Wow. Well, that's the proverbial great problem to have. Jeez. That's awesome. Well, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is Stacey LeBaron, who hosts the Community Cats podcast, in which she interviews guests about the cat overpopulation problem and various aspects of cat welfare. If you'd like to ask Stacey a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663, email dj at wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. So I guess with the way that you speak and with the accomplishments and the passion and clear knowledge that you have, what led to your decision to leave MRFRS, I guess for short, and launch the podcast?
Yeah, so I actually moved out of the area, so that was one of the reasons why.
Okay.
And then I also felt that, you know, I had been there for so many years that it was time for me to move on. I tend to be a sprouter by personality. I'm not much of a nurturer, I guess, so I always want to start new projects. If somebody suggests something saying, hey, this might be a little bit out of the box, I'll be like, oh, great, I'm already in. You know, it sounds exciting. I ran a mentoring program for about 3 years while at the Merrimack River Feline Rescue Society. So I had the privilege to work with about 80 organizations across the country in helping them with their community cat programs. Unfortunately, when I left the Merrimack River Feline Rescue Society, I had a waiting list of over 400 groups waiting for assistance.
Waiting to get into your mentoring program?
Correct.
Wow. Correct.
So there was huge demand out there. People want help. Organizations want help. There's lots of different questions out there for how to help community cats. People want to help cats. So I felt, well, what could I do to help reach them, knowing that mentoring 400 groups was going to be really tough for one person? So I had spent quite a bit of time in the car driving, and I had started listening to podcasts. And at the same time, my then 12-year-old son was starting to play the electric guitar, and he was recording his music, and he told me how easy it would be to start a podcast. And so because of my son, Scott, I got in the podcasting business.
That's cool. I mean, it's interesting. I spoke to someone else who's been deep into podcasts for actually a long time, Colleen Patrick Goudreau. You might be familiar with her. And she kind of described a similar thing in that her husband was a professional musician and they had all this equipment. So it just seemed like it was kind of a combination of interest, sort of unclear how to achieve it, and hey, there's this equipment that you could record with. Let's give it a whirl. So it sounds like that all came together in your case as well.
Yeah, no, and it was, and a couple of other people had sort of mentioned, you know what, you should do a podcast. And so then when my son got me going, I then reached out to those folks and I said, you know what you said? Well, I'm going to take you up on the offer of getting involved and helping me. So I certainly don't do this all by myself. I have a group of about five other people that helped make the show happen.
Well, that's cool. I want to get into a few more details like that. But when you were, between the time that your son said, hey, you could really do this, and you were kind of looking around for what would be a way to build on the mentoring program and the tremendous demand that you couldn't obviously meet, when you were conceiving the podcast itself, what did you deem were the most significant element? What did you know was going to be central to your shows, and when did you know it? Kind of question. So obviously it was a cat focus. When did you decide, for example, that it would be 3 times a week versus once or twice a week?
Right. So I initially started the show out at 5 times a week. And so that was, you know, very adventuresome and fun. I had a great Rolodex of connections of people that I'd spoken to over the years. And basically what I thought was, when I would chat with folks that I knew in the industry, we have these incredible conversations. And I was always like, wow, I wish I could share these conversations with the wide world, because they were always so enlightening and I always learned something new every time I spoke with folks. So basically, it was pretty simple in terms of I just wanted to share my phone calls basically with people that wanted to learn more about how to help community cats. And my focus was always on community cats, because my focus is on population control, you know, as well as overall wellness. I mean, I really think we can create a humane cat community out there, and population control is one component of it. So there are certainly other aspects to it. That's my sort of personal soapbox issue, is right, the neuter part of it. But I do cross into the other areas and represent sort of the whole toolkit of success. So I started out at 5 days a week, and I did step back to 3 days a week when I launched my Community Cat Grants program, which is a mentoring program which mentors groups in fundraising expertise. It's sort of like the AP class in fundraising.
Okay.
So it's teaching a group that really hasn't focused on fundraising for spay-neuter to do a 3-month fundraiser, and then I have grant funding that will match up to $1,000. So this is for small organizations with revenues under $100,000 a year to really do something new, something outside of their comfort zone. So I launched that program, and then I've also been doing some webinars, too.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask about that, because there was one, I think, just last weekend that made me think that we'd come back to that as well. But, and if I'm not mistaken, by the way, I think you launched the podcast a year ago to the day, right?
Yeah.
So
my
happy
1 year anniversary.
Right, so happy anniversary. Well, you seem like you've accomplished a great deal. And how long did it take you to say, okay, 5 days a week, okay, got to scale back?
I think we scaled back after about 6 months. Somewhere in that period. Yeah, I mean, I've done over 200 episodes.
Well, as I said to you in an initial email, I feel like a slacker. I work incredibly hard, and it seems like a big struggle to get 1 hour a week pulled together. So maybe I need to sign up for your mentoring program myself. But it's very impressive, and you're obviously covering a lot of ground, and there are offshoots of it, like the grant program and the webinars, et cetera. So all in all, like a year in, how do you feel it's going? I mean, what are the highlights of the podcast so far? Show us where your intent and the guest interview maybe meshed particularly deftly, where it even kind of exceeded your expectation.
Yeah, I mean, I was actually just looking at the list of the guests that I've had on the show earlier this morning, and I'm like, oh, how can I choose? But, you know, obviously interviewing Jackson Galaxy was a real thrill, and Hannah Shaw, who I just had the Kitten Lady webinar with this past weekend, has been an incredible supporter of the show, and she's just magnificent, and I've learned so much from her just in terms of social media. I mean, as you know, running a show, there's so much that goes on with the outreach about it.
Yeah.
And I've learned a lot from her. And being in the cat world, it's very much of a visual market. So really being able to take advantage and leveraging on that. From the spay-neuter side of things, I mean, I always love speaking with the folks at Alley Cat Allies and Neighborhood Cats. It's just, you know, each show I come out of there and I'm like, oh my goodness, I still am learning new things every day. You know, I have interviewed so many different people. I've learned about what's going on with community cats in Beijing, Galapagos Islands, Hawaii, you know, in all different parts of the United States. I play this game with Katie Lisnick of HSUS. We call it Policy Jeopardy. And so I just ask her sort of what's going on with advocacy issues in different states in around the country. And so she fills me in what's going on. And I think that's a really cute show. I really enjoy it. And we also have an Ask Stacy show where people get to ask me questions too, which is kind of fun.
Right, and again, periodically breaking format to review books, obviously mostly cat related books. So yeah, you do mix it up. And but yeah, it's funny you'd say about the things that you learn, because I was going to ask about that. To me, one of the gigantic perks I find of doing a show is that I feel like I know a fair amount about a certain topic and I prepare for that given interview. And then I walk away learning something either in the preparation and or the interview itself, where I just thought, oh my God, this is, you know, and so I obviously hope that extends to the listeners. Since you came into the podcast so knowledgeable and had run that organization for so many years and launched all those different successful programs. How often are you learning things, and what are some of the more notable things that you have learned in the course of the year that you've done the podcast?
Yeah, so one other reason I think for me doing this podcast is when I spoke earlier about how, you know, it was all about Adam and Eve, and it was a very simple vision from my standpoint, which is like, let's just get everybody, all the cats spayed and neutered, and the world's going to be a happy place. I think that the next 10 years for community cats and for cats in general, the challenges may be different. So sheltering may look different for cats. I just had a long conversation about developing cat cafes all around the country as a way to be able to showcase cats that are looking for homes rather than shelters. So I'm now in sort of this discovery process of trying to figure out, you know, once we've crossed that spay-neuter, high-volume spay-neuter, you know, accessible, affordable spay-neuter bridge, what's our next step in creating that humane cat community? So it's really a discovery path that I'm on.
Well, it's interesting. A couple of things, by the way, I should back up and say for people listening who this may or may not be as clear as it should be. When we say community cats, are we really using that term in lieu of feral cats?
So when I use the term community cats, I mean it to be any cat with four paws on the ground that is not spayed or neutered or has identification of ownership.
Does have or does not have identification?
Does not.
Okay, right, yeah. Okay, so for a lot of people, that would mean, among other things, feral cats, if unlike you guys, and where you guys were at least, the colony are still flourishing and there's plenty of them, that's how the community cat phrase would apply there, for example.
Right. I mean, there's the gray area of the quasi-owned cat.
Yeah.
And so that is included in community cats.
Okay, so I wanted to just make sure that was clear for people listening. And also the thing about cafes, I know you had just a recent interview that really highlighted that, and I do think it's a really interesting trend because it is part sort of business model for some people coming at it from that angle. And then some people are really coming at it more from a shelter. Here's how we could really kick up some major adoptions is have these cats here hanging out. We serve coffee. Maybe we serve some other stuff. And the people get to hang with the cats, pet the cats, hopefully want to adopt the cats. In the run-up to speaking to you today, I saw a Facebook post from a friend who actually lives out in L.A., who was frustrated because she was trying to go to a similar operation there, and that she couldn't get in because I guess it was booked.
Yeah. Like,
so, I mean, it really seems to have taken off.
Yeah, they're very popular, which is fantastic. It's great. And I think it's just going to be interesting to see how it impacts the needs of the sheltering community.
Yeah.
And in reality, only about 20% of people get their cats from a shelter network or from a shelter. So, you know, is our objective to increase that percentage, or is our what's our objective in trying to reach out to all of these cats in the community? And so some of our help may be more in the form of offering medical assistance as a cat ages, and if somebody can't afford the high veterinary care, maybe more vaccines or low-cost microchipping for identification purposes. So there's so many more things that we can do in the community other than sheltering to be able to help the overall well-being of cats in the community.
Stacey, when you say 20% of people get cats from shelters, generally where does what constitutes the other 80%?
So 50 to 55% is like friends and family. So, you know, somebody's found a stray cat in their backyard and they're looking for a home for it. Then there's pet shops. Then there are breeders, and, you know, then there's, like, online resources, like, you know, an online listing service.
So various things that are maybe can be nefarious, some not so much, but...
Right.
So I got you. Okay. Now that you have hit the one-year mark with the Community Cats podcast, I'd be interested to hear you sort of compare the experience and impact of producing and hosting the show relative to the experience and impact of leading the Merrimack River Feline Rescue Society. I mean, obviously, you've done the podcast just, you know, literally a year as of today, as we've established.
Yep.
So it's a very unequal equation in terms of number of years. But just in terms of your feeling and your sense of accomplishment and impact, how does that feel so far?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm always going to be tremendously proud of the work that I did with the Merrimack River Feline Rescue Society and being able to assist over 100,000 cats and impact and make change. You know, is forever near and dear to my heart. And you know, a Catmobile. I'm one of the few people that can say I owned a Catmobile at one point in time. So that's kind of pretty cool.
Yeah.
It's very different in terms of the day-to-day emotions and stress that I feel. It's obviously, I felt a huge level of responsibility for all the lives of the cats that were, you know, in our shelter, and our staff and our employees. Managing staff is very different than, you know, being your own virtual podcaster in the woods of Vermont. And so it's very different, but the thing that I've learned over the last year is I actually have found that we are much more farther along in this process in helping cats across the country than I actually thought we were when I started on this journey. So meeting the organizations, I've become even more optimistic, which for those that know me, they know me as a perpetual optimist. So I'm even more optimistic about how things are going for community cats. There are definitely areas that I've seen where there's significant challenges. And I feel for the frustration for the people that are in those areas, but it's just incredible what's going on across the country. I mean, people are feeling the love, and they're doing the right thing, and they're working, you know, efficiently and effectively, and it is hard. It's hard being in the trenches, and, you know, I've talked about compassion fatigue on the show, because over 20 years I've certainly had my low points being hands-on, and it's tough. It's definitely, it's really, really tough. And I want to make sure that we acknowledge that and we, you know, help each other through those times. Doing the podcast is, I feel like I'm just able to really celebrate everybody's hard work and efforts. And if I can help anybody by spreading the word on the work that they're doing, I'm here to do it.
So, Stacey, with the work on the podcast and prior and sort of overlapping the mentoring work, have you found with what you're talking about, what's going on nationally, that what the results were and the situation was at MRFRS is not really as much as an anomaly as it might sound to some listening here that know that at least in certain areas, the cat situation, the cat overpopulation situation, et cetera, can be tough and sometimes sort of overwhelming?
Yeah, I think that one of the things with the growth with the Humane Alliance Clinic, so it's a sort of a franchise model that's run by the ASPCA. Humane Alliance Clinics are high-volume spay-neuter clinics, and they've been around for like 15, 17 years, and I think they have about 200 clinics all across the country. I think with the development of those, as well as, you know, individual clinics that have developed, the whole desire to have high-volume, high-quality, affordable spay-neuter clinics all across the country, the fact that there is a need for that for cats and for dogs is a game changer.
Okay, so this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Stacey LeBaron, who hosts the Community Cats podcast, featuring interviews conducted with guests about the cat overpopulation problem and various aspects of cat welfare. We invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. So one of our emailers here, Stacey, says in a subject line, says cat irresponsibility. And then it says, I'm curious to know what is being done to educate the public about how bad it is to own indoor-outdoor cats. The rate that cats help destroy various native wildlife around the world is astronomical. The fact that there are so many irresponsible cat owners around the world, specifically in the U.S., leads me to think the government should be taking extreme measures to stop these cats from flourishing.
So that's it's a question that I get posed quite a bit, being in the Newburyport, Mass area. We're home of the piping plover up there. So we are definitely in bird territory, as well as the fact that there's this thought that cats and dogs need to have the same services. You know, so there's dog licensing, so why don't we have cat licensing? And so there's a trying to have an understanding of why cats are being treated a little bit different than dogs. One thing that's an interesting statistic to keep in mind is that as your income level goes up, the number of dogs you have go up. As your income level goes down, the number of cats you have goes up. So I refer to cats as being pets of the poor. So it's not a question of not caring, not being responsible for these animals. It's that cats tend to be pets of the poor. And if you're poor, you can only do so much. And oftentimes, if you have, you know, you're going to the local food bank, we ran into a situation where a gentleman was getting macaroni and cheese, you know, Kraft macaroni and cheese from the food bank, and he was feeding them to his 60 cats. And so people will forego their own food and feed people food to cats. So when we're looking at our cat programs, we need to really make sure that they are serving that population. And if we can get the services into that community, then you are going to see substantial improvement in terms of the numbers of cats that are free roaming. Once a cat is spayed or neutered, then you're most likely going to keep that cat indoors because it's if it's a neutered male cat, if you try and have an unneutered male cat in your house, good luck with that one because, you know, it's going to not smell so good.
Yeah.
But you get the boy cat neutered, then you're going to start keeping him in. So if we can get these programs specifically targeted in areas where people's income level are $35,000 and less, that seems to be a benchmark figure going down, then you're going to see an incredible change in the quality of life and care for those cats.
So it sounds like really in terms of addressing this emailer's concerns that a byproduct, really, of the continuing progress with spay and neuter and community cats will address this emailer's question about how the native wildlife and other things are affected by the cats that are indoor-outdoor cats.
Well, our objective is the same as theirs.
Yeah.
Our objective is reducing the population of free-roaming cats that are out there.
Yeah.
And so we're both on the same page, and the question is the process and the timing. Until we can figure out why people abandon their cats, and that is definitely a larger question, until we can figure out why that happens or how to prevent that from happening, then we need to have boots on the ground, we need to have neighbors in the community with access to these free and low-cost programs to be able to ensure that Adam and Eve don't get abandoned. And if they do, they're already spayed and neutered.
Stacey, we just have maybe a minute, maybe two left, but by some estimations, this is Adopt-A-Cat Month, and it's unquestionably kitten season. So I want to talk just for our remaining time a little bit about the, sort of the regional differences in the, I guess, supply and demand, for lack of a better phrase, of kittens and cats.
Yep.
For example, yesterday, the Palm Beach Post carried a story about the Peggy Adams Animal Rescue League, which is a pretty major first-rate shelter in West Palm Beach, and their plans to fly 40 cats, mostly kittens, I think, to the North Shore Animal League on Long Island. What are your thoughts on that? And sort of less high-end means, it's a frequently travel that doesn't involve flying animals from one region to another. But what does that tell us, and what are your thoughts on that?
Transport is a hot topic, that's
yeah.
for sure. I mean, it's been that way for the dogs for quite a few years. And, you know, from coming from the Northeast, where I'm located, there is quite a flow of kitten and cat transport traffic coming up into this area. I think it is a reactive program that is necessary to help alleviate certain stresses in the shelter environment at certain times of the year. However, I feel very strongly, thus the mentoring programs that I've worked on, that it's very important to have that aggressive spay-neuter component in the community because you're just going to continue needing that assistance over and over and over again if you just keep doing it. But if you're out there and basically getting every cat possible, spayed and neutered, regardless of what the price point is, then you're not going to need to do a very expensive transport program, which it is expensive.
It did seem like, transport, it seems like it's an ongoing topic, as you say, but it happens in various ways to help clear out shelters, and especially ones that where some of those animals might be right on the cusp of a pretty dark fate. But
Yep. But
some of that does seem to, as you kind of noted, in this case maybe, sort of address the symptom rather than the kind of underlying affliction. So it does seem like, there still needs to be every bit as much emphasis on spay and neuter and other programs that would ultimately reduce the burgeoning population to begin with.
And I would add, don't forget to check in with your neighbors. I mean, it's really important to know what's going on in your state because you might have transfer partners within your state. We were in what I call the kitten-free zone as of the late 90s in Newburyport. So we were driving to Springfield, Massachusetts to get 40 kittens and bringing them into our foster care network because we didn't have enough kittens in our community to be able to supply the demands of our client base. So there may be shifts within your own state that you can do to help balance things out also.
Very good point. All right, Stacey, well, we are unfortunately have reached the end of our time, but this has been Stacey LeBaron, and she hosts the Community Cats Podcast. The website for that is communitycatspodcast.com, where you can listen to past programs and find out all kinds of information. Well, unfortunately, we didn't really get a chance to talk about the occasional webinars, including one you just offered this weekend, but there's all kinds of other information and blog posts and resources and great stuff there. So it's communitycatspodcast.com, and the show itself is the Community Cats Podcast. Stacey, thanks so much for joining us today on Talking Animals.
Thanks, Duncan.
In a few moments, I'll speak with Gina Kaiser about a forthcoming benefit in Palm Harbor for Paws with a Cause. Right now, it's time to step into the Comedy Corner with a piece from Mark Maron. But this ain't exactly a WTF conversation. This is a piece called Masturbating Among the Animals from Mark Maron in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
Here's a question for you. A little window into my life. I'll see. I'm assuming dogs are easier. I don't own dogs, but I guess they just want to be part of something, huh? That's really up to you, depending on how slippery your personal moral slope is and what you can rationalize effectively. But I got four cats on my bed, and they will just sit there and quietly judge. I take it out. They're like, really? Really? We're doing that again? Really? Does that make you feel better, sad man? Does that make me pain go away? Well, we'll just sit here grooming until you get done with your pathetic autoerotic hobby. But I'll leave him on the bed. I don't put him off the bed because I never want to hear myself say, Daddy's done. Come on back up, Caleb. So I'd just shoot myself in the head if that happened.
That was Mark Maron with a piece called Masturbating Among the Animals, taken from his album Final Engagement. Now, on to my conversation with Gina Kaiser about this benefit for Paws with a Cause. Let's welcome Gina Kaiser to Talk Animals. Good morning, Gina.
Hey, Duncan. How are you? Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Thanks for joining us on Talk Animals. So let's first start off, for many folks perhaps that may not be familiar with it, tell us what Paws with a Cause is and what its mission is and how it works.
Paws with a Cause is a national service dog organization that places service dogs with those with disabilities. What's unique about this organization is we have field reps all over the United States, and I'm the local field rep here in the Tampa area, and there are field reps all over Florida. So when a dog is placed, we place it with the dog and give ongoing support, which many organizations don't do. Their mission is to enhance independence for people, to make better quality life for them with their disabilities through our custom-trained service dogs. And they are custom-trained. We train it to the disability. Not everybody needs the same things in their disability, so we do needs assessments. The field reps go out and do it, and we train the dogs to the disability.
So let me see if I understand you. So I assume they're probably fundamentally trained first in sort of more general skills of being a service dog. And then you're saying at a certain point, like how much time is devoted to say, okay, we're going to custom train them to help this person over here. How much time and how does that work exactly? Because that's kind of a cool, unusual element.
Well, you are absolutely right. They have to be trained first and, of course, their basic skills. But the thing is, it's the hard, the answer varies because we train dogs for physically impaired, hearing alert dogs, seizure response dogs, and autism. We also train dogs for veterans. So it depends on what the need is. Hearing dogs, we can usually be 2 to 4 months training. We can have a hearing dog ready. The service dogs generally, as they work mostly for people in wheelchairs, they have much more skill they need to learn. So it can take up to 6 months of training or so to get them to where we need them to be.
And so, again, whether it's a couple months or 6 months, depending on what how specific and the kind of skills involved. I mean, are they living then with that person as part of the training or just spending a certain amount of time each day? I mean, how does that actually work before they're deemed ready to serve that person every day?
This is a unique thing about Paws. They're headquartered in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And the dogs are bred and trained up in Michigan. The field reps Say someone applies for a dog. They are deemed to be a good candidate. They send it then to the field rep, which would be me. Say there's someone in the Tampa area. I would go to that person. I would bring my service dog with me, my demo dog, and we would do an in-depth video interview, finding out what the needs are, what the person needs. I write up a report and send that video back to PAWS. They look at it, and now this is the interesting part. Our dogs are free. We are a nonprofit organization, so there's no cost to the client. But they have to get funding in place. They get funding in place, and when that is in place, then they start working, finding the dog that will fit that client best. That's in temperament as well as work ethic, you know, the type of work the dog would do.
Well, that sounds cool. I mean, the fact that it's no cost to the client is, of course, phenomenal, just because those dogs all have such a high degree of training before they even get into the specialized training for that particular client. But
the actual cost of a dog is $30,000 from the beginning to the end. So, but we don't charge for that. It is totally through donations and benefactors.
But I would think, too, with the tremendous demand, like continuing your example of meeting with someone, writing up a report, sending it back to Michigan, I can't imagine that they have the resources or the dogs, trained dogs, to fulfill every request. So how do they determine who's going to be lucky enough to get one of those dogs?
Well, I'll tell you that, but I want to finish part of the sequence. After that report goes and they find the person's, they train the dog for that person, then I go to Michigan, I get the dog, I bring it to the person, and then I teach the person how to use the dog. If the dog needs more skill, I then train the dog on site, and we give ongoing support. Many service dog agencies, you spend 2 weeks, and you're on your own with your dog. We give continued support. Now, who determines who gets the dog? You're right. The demand is huge for these dogs. We get sometimes 3,000 applications a year, and we only can place, 75 dogs a year. We do give preference. We try to give preference to people that have had a dog. One of our dogs whose dog has died or gotten, aged too old to work, to be able to work, we try to give them preference because they've had a dog and they know what it's like and they know what their loss is. It's sort of, I don't want to say first come, first serve, but the applications come in and we fill them as we can.
Wow. Yeah, well, that's got to be some tough decision-making there at headquarters or with your input,
well,
et cetera.
Some of it does have to do with if we have the right dog for that client. I mean, somebody may be higher up on the food chain, but, if we don't have a dog that fits their needs yet, we have to wait for the right dog to come along for them.
Yeah. Okay, so I don't want to run out of time to, as fascinating as this is, and people can find out more by going to the pawswithacause.org website. But let's also find out about this local Palm Harbor benefit that's going to help with the Paws for a Cause.
Well, this will be a good people to gather information there as well. We're having a benefit the 30th of June, and there will be demo dogs there, and we will be doing a whole demonstration with the service dogs to show them all the skills they actually can do, and it's great to see a dog actually live doing it. And we'll be answering questions there and giving more information. It's going to be at Palm Harbor Dance Studio, which is 32828 U.S. Highway 19 North in Palm Harbor. We're right behind Chick-fil-A and that shopping center. There'll be refreshments, and we invite anyone to come out and learn more about our dogs. And, it's a fundraiser to help us try and, if people choose to, help us raise funds.
Yeah, and provide the dogs and the services that go with those dogs.
Exactly.
I guess. Yeah. Gina, is there either a Facebook page or website where people who may be driving around say, I mentioned this, but I didn't catch all the details, where they could refer back to the information for the night of the 30th?
If they go to our Facebook page, it's Palm Harbor Dance Studio. Palm Harbor Dance Studio. The benefit starts at 7 o'clock. Doors open at 7.
Okay.
And the dog, as I said, Maya will be there with my service dog to do a complete demonstration of all they do and explain more about the organization. It's just great to learn about the information and learn what the dogs can do.
And we are out of time at this point, Gene, but I just want to note that if I'm not mistaken, in addition to the kind of the serious introduction of the services that can be provided and how those dogs can help, at one point in the evening, will the dog not do, the dogs maybe not do some dancing themselves?
Oh, yes, I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, when they are not in cape, as we call it, when they don't have their work cape on, yes, we're going to have the dogs dance. I've titled one dog. It's called Freestyle, a movement to music with your dog. But they'll see them dance that night as well. And
great.
It's kind of a special surprise that night, too, in that vein.
All right. Well, Gina, thank you so much. This sounds like a wonderful organization and a great evening on June 30th. So thank you so much for joining us today on Talking Animals.
And thank you for having me on.
You bet.
Bye.
Coming up at 11 on WNF, it's Rob Lori and Radioactivity, kicking off a three-hour block of interviews, phone calls, news, and more, including in the noon hour, Midpoint with Nola Lele. Then at 1 p.m., Craig Kopp presides over executive session. Meanwhile, we're going to get into Name That Animal Tune, and we do have a DVD of that great documentary, Cowspiracy, is the prize. Please only participate, though, if you haven't won something in the last 90 days. And if you can name this animal tune, call 813-239-9663 and correctly identify it. It's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals. If you can name that animal tune, we'll have to take it off the air after the show, because we have reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Stay tuned for Rob Lori and Radioactivity. I'll be back next Wednesday, June 28th, when my guest will be Jessica Rubin, a University of Connecticut law professor who's at the forefront of a Connecticut law making it the first state to provide animals with court-appointed advocates to represent them in abuse and cruelty cases, not unlike those that provide victims or children's advocates. So go to TalkingAnimals.net for audio archives, links to the Facebook, Twitter feed, Facebook page, etc. It's WMNF Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weeki Wachee, and beyond. Thanks for listening. Speak to you next Wednesday at 10 a.m.